Okay, I think we'll begin now. Welcome everyone to Tradition and Revolution, the story of the founding of Beis Yaakov and the Beis Yaakov movement. This is part one, and I'm very excited to share this topic with you. Tonight we'll set the scene for the founding of Beis Yaakov and what was the revolutionary effect that Sarah Schneer had in her movement. And to understand that, we have to really understand the context and the situation that was in Europe and in the Jewish community at large. I would invite everyone to turn their videos on if they're able to. I think it adds a lot to the shield. I understand if they're not able to, but I would love to see everyone's faces. So welcome everyone. And let's begin. There's a story told that Rav Yecheskel Sarna, the great Rosh Yeshiva in the Yeshiva of Hebron, was once at a bris, and many very well-known and legendary figures were at this bris, including the grandson of the Ger Rebbe, the grandson of the Alter Slabodka, who we spoke about in our previous series on Musar, the grandson of the Alter of Nevardik, the great grandson of the Chafetz Chaim. There were many, many important figures at this bris, and Rav Yecheskel Sarna got up, and he said to everyone in the room, thinks that their grandfather did the most for Klal Yisrael, for the Jewish people. And I want to tell you that no one here did the most for Klal Yisrael, and people were very taken. What is Rav Yecheskel saying? People said, "Don't start up. Don't start a whole machlokas, a whole dispute over here. Just get down. Don't start up with anyone." People said, "Quiet down. Quiet down." And then he added, and Rav Yecheskel did not stop, and he said, "I'll tell you one other thing. Once I tell you who this person's name is, every single person here is going to agree with me." Everyone was shocked, outrageous. How could this be? And then he said, "I'll add one more thing. This person never studied a black Gemara in their life." And after he said the name, "The name that I have that I want to share with you is Sarah Schneer. Sarah Schneer." And everyone agreed. Everyone at this bris, I'm not sure why it was at a bris, why that was a very important thing that he wanted to share. I'm sure there was a context there. And they all agreed. And the entire Jewish world would look completely different had Sarah Schneer not created this revolution. And I'll talk to you more about this as we develop it, this revolution, complete new movement, possibly the most important movement in the Jewish community of the 20th century. Now, I'm sure some may say the story, she did study Gemara, perhaps. I can't prove one or the other. It seems from the scholarship she did have at least access to some text in the Yiddish translation, and she was a very learned woman. So whether she did or did not study Gemara, that's not my point. We could discuss women learning Gemara, perhaps, if we have time for the general discussion about women's learning, and I want to spend some time on that. But I want to tell you the story and why it was so important, why everyone at this bris, everyone from across the spectrum, agrees that Sarah Schneer did more for Klal Yisrael than all these very well established, I would say, household names, the Chafetz Chaim, and we'll talk about the Chafetz Chaim's support of the movement. But Sarah Schneer, as an individual, did perhaps more. It's hard to really, hindsight is 2020, but she changed the face of the Torah world. And I want to talk about what the community was going through, what were the challenges that Beis Yaakov and Sarah Schneer in particular were they facing, and what was the community like at that time? So now that most of the people are here, I'm going to put the source sheet in the chat, and that way you can follow along. And part of the time I'm going to share my screen, part of the time I won't, but here is the source sheet that you can have. If you click on the link in the chat, you should be able to download it, and you can have it for yourself. So I'm going to share my screen now anyways. That way we can look at this together. So I'll go up to the top here. So this picture is a very well-known picture. It actually is the front cover of the book that I am primarily using. I'll tell you some of my sources before we get going. It's a picture, not of Sarah Schneer, but it is a picture of the Beis Yaakov Seminary in Rabka in 1929, their summer training program. And as you can see, it's a, you know, the girls are listening very intently. It's a very powerful scene in the country, in Poland. And this is some of the materials that I have been using.
Can you make it bigger?
Yeah, I'll make it bigger. So first of all, I'll show you some of the books here I have with me. First of all, this is a new book, Naomi Simon's book. She actually lives in Toronto, and we hope to have a conversation with her. That's called The Sarah Schneer and the Beis Yaakov Movement. This is a classic book, Carry Me in Your Heart. That's a book that I've utilized. Many people know about that. This is a book about Rebbetzin Vichna Kaplan, which we'll talk about her founding the Beis Yaakov Movement in America. And back to some of my materials here, there are multiple articles that I have used. Rachel Mannequin and her husband have an important article that they wrote together. She also has a work that just came out a few years ago. I didn't get access to all of it, but I saw a review of it called The Rebellion of the Daughters. Naomi Simon has an entire archive, the Beis Yaakov Project, which she has artifacts, pictures, and records, and maps. And so I utilize that a lot. Rabbi Reuven Brand has had a shiur on Yud Torah that has a source sheet I utilized. And a good friend of mine, Yehuda Geber, who is the host of the Jewish History Soundbites podcast, did a series on this. And he is a historian, lecturer, and tour guide. And so I use some of his materials as well. Feel free anytime to jump in. This is, you know, my goal is to just sort of create as much interaction as people want. And this is really an exploration. And I would love to hear your thoughts on this, because there's a lot of sort of popular knowledge, and then there's the scholarship. And
this is what I meant to put out.
I would love to hear everyone's, you know, I never went to a Beis Yaakov, disclaimer. So I would love to hear everyone's thoughts if anyone has to offer. So this first source that I just read, this story for you, that was in the introduction to Carry Him in Your Heart by Rabbi Noach Weinberg. So that is what we just read. And I would like to show you this picture. This is a picture of the 1903 Rabbinical Conference in Krakow. So in the same year as the Sixth Zionist Congress in Basel, 1903, where Theodore Herzl presented the famous Uganda Plan, which became very hotly debated. In another part of Europe, there was another less famous convention, but not any less important. And it was called together by a rabbi by the name of the Ashkenazic rabbi of Cairo, Rabbi Aaron Mendel HaKohen. Rabbi Aaron Mendel HaKohen is pictured up to the top left over here. And he felt very important that everybody meet together in Krakow to devote their time it was really a new idea. This idea of a conference had not been done before in this framework in modern times. And he felt that the issues of the day needed to be confronted. Modernity, assimilation, secularization, new education laws, which we'll talk about, and different political changes. And he felt we need to get together. We need to have a conference. And there was pushback. There was pushback by Rabbanim that didn't want to come. They were pushed back by people who didn't feel they wanted to be, you know, they could be outvoted. It was controversial even to call the meeting. And at this conference, they were discussing education, the need for, reform in the cheder system, which was in definite need of reform. And all of a sudden, girls' education comes on the agenda. And this is why this conference is very important. A rabbi by the name of Rav Menachem Mendel Chaim Landau, if I'm not mistaken, it's a little bit hard to read over here, I believe he is the bottom middle over here. I think that is, I'm not sure. I'm not sure which one he is. But in any case, he was the rabbi of Nowy Dwór. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. It's a small town in Poland, Nowy Dwór. And he talked and he openly apologized. He said, I'm sorry to bring this up. It's a very difficult topic, but our Jewish girls are leaving the fold. And he brought up, there are many references to certain issues that we will talk about, which are difficult to really wrap our heads around. But there were tens and, you know, we got hundreds of girls that were going to public schools, that were actually sent to Catholic schools. And we'll talk about some of the girls who didn't have any access to education. And Rabbi Lando got up and he said, I think we should create Talmud Torahs for girls. And this created a whole stir. And Rav Eliyahu Akiva Rabinovich, a well-known and dynamic leader at the time, he said, it's impossible. It will never happen. It is forbidden. Women learning Torah, it's never been done. It will not happen. And this conference, although it's an important historical event, was pretty much a failure. They definitely talked about the issues, but they did not come to any particular resolution. And the agenda that was raised about women's education, women's Torah learning, was pretty much, there was no implementation of that particular agenda. However, it did get the ball rolling, and it did, in a sense, bring the attention of the rabbinate, and it also created the potential for an Orthodox political movement. So why did Rabbi Landau, why did he feel the need to bring up this issue? What was he talking about where he apologizes? He apologizes for bringing up this difficult, painful issue. What painful issue was he talking about? So we have to back up a step and understand what time period we're living in and what's going on. We're in the age of isms. We're in the age of you know, after the French Revolution. It's the time of upheaval, the Enlightenment. And in Galicia, which that's where the Beis Yaakov movement really begins in Poland, we are, you know, in the 19th century, we're living at a time in that period where they were beginning, the laws of equality and rights were starting to be given. And there was something, you know, within that framework called the compulsory education law. Now, the compulsory education law of 1869, it was, you know, I guess you could say was involved with granting equal rights to people. But at the end of the day, practical ramifications that it had on the Jewish community were huge. So what happened was, in similar to the public school system today in different countries, you had a requirement to educate your child. And that had not been the case beforehand. And this was happening in Hungary and in Galicia and different areas. And this law was passed, and all of a sudden, all the boys and the girls were obligated to go to public school. So these traditional, more conservative elements in the community would have none of it. We're not going to send our boys to the public schools. We need to give them their Torah education. We need to teach them. So what happened was these communities were sending their girls in mass to public schools in order to save their boys. What do I mean? Because there were certain quotas and certain numbers. If you flood the schools and there's no room left for the girls, for the boys, then they were free to go to the chadarim and free to go to the yeshivas. So what happened was, all these communities had a tremendous amount of change that was going on in these decades that came after 1869, where you had all the boys still going to these traditional chadarim, but the girls were going to public schools. And some Hasidic families actually prefer the Catholic schools, because the Catholic schools, although they're learning about, you know, other religions, but at least they were still all girls. They were not co-ed. So pushing this even, even further, the Gerer Rebbe is quoted in as saying that he had many, many students, thousands of Gera Hasidim, but he had no matches for them, no Shidduchim. We have a modern day Shidduch crisis. However, the opposite. In nowadays, we have seemingly many eligible girls without, you know, for some reason, the boys seem to be on a low, you know, not as many to bachelors. And that in those communities, there were not as many girls because all the girls were going to public school. They were meeting, you know, different boys. They were becoming much more polarized, I guess is the word. Polarized is probably the word. They were becoming part of the culture. Many of them did not know Hebrew. They learned Polish. Some of them didn't even know Yiddish. And they were much, much more acculturated, much more assimilated. And the thinking was, well, once they get to the chuppah, then already they'll become a rebbetzin. But all of a sudden, they have these arranged marriages. The parents are living in the old world before the Enlightenment. They arrange this marriage there are many different Hasidic sects, but Ger was the largest. Alexander was another one, and they, you know, Bells was another one, and they prearrange this marriage. They get to the chuppah and they say, "I'm not interested in marrying this archaic, you know, prosaic guy. I'm not interested. He's a nebuch. I read philosophy. I read literature. I like dance and theater. And this guy is, you know, all he knows is the cheder world." So what happens because of these changes, and this is part of what Rabbi Landau was apologizing for, and I also would like to just warn you, this is shocking. I have to admit, it's shocking to hear about this, but it seems to be, you know, documented in a couple of sources, which we can go through together. Shaul Stampler, who is a from historian, who I actually spoke with Rabbi Mordechai Willig last night, and he said, if Shaul Stampler says it, then I believe it. He's a very chashuv historian, and he documents an issue of human trafficking and prostitution. That what was going on at the time, and we hear murmurings of this in the sources, in the traditional stories of women going off the derech and people leaving the fold, but it wasn't just that they were leaving the fold. There were people who were stuck in arranged marriages. They felt they had no way out, and they would run away from home. They would run away. They would join a convent, a Catholic convent at times. Sometimes they got, unfortunately, involved in prostitution, in other ways that they would try to extricate themselves from these situations. They had no financial, they were very poverty-stricken, and they had no financial means of their own. They were trying to basically leave their communities. And unfortunately, sometimes unbeknownst to them, they would get involved or they would be offered to, this wealthy man in America, and there were people who would, you know, ret the shidduch, they would suggest a match, and then they would all of a sudden take them off and say they need to meet this man, and they would really, you know, get them involved in these terrible, you know, human trafficking issues. And it wasn't only just kidnapping, it was also people who were choosing this way of life. So I'll just give you one story, which was a very prominent story. Obviously, we're not talking about this, it was on the fringes of what was happening. It wasn't like in every area, and it wasn't out of control. I mean, how could we call it out of control? It's a terrible issue. It's a terrible issue, and any one case is a terrible issue. But I it seems to be it was more on the fringes of the community. However, there was one case that went very, we would say today, it went viral. In those days, it was in the press. It was a girl by the name of Anna Kluger. So Anna Kluger was born to a Hasidic home. She was actually a great-granddaughter of the Divrei Chaim. She was a Halberstam, so she was come from, you know, aristocracy, and she was came from a very wealthy family, and like many of those families, the family sent her to public school. That was the normal thing to do in those days, and she decided that the arranged marriage that her parents organized for her wasn't she wasn't interested. So what she does is she leaves the community, and she had actually seemingly some more financial means here. So she wasn't stuck like other women were. And she decided she's going to sue her parents for preventing her from furthering her education and make them pay for her furthering her education. In fact, she goes to go on to become, to get a PhD in Polish history. And why it made the press is because you have this woman suing her family, coming from a Hasidic home, and she's trying to get an education. As you can imagine, that made a lot of people very happy, very upset. You know, it was a very hot topic, and it made its rounds in the community. So let's look at a couple sources just to get a sense of, beyond these issues of, beyond just leaving the fold. Like I mentioned to you, the different people that were the different important factors and the different issues that were facing the community. So I want to talk to you a little bit about a woman by the name of Bertha Pappenheim. I think that she probably pronounced it Bertha. So I'll share my screen with you. And so here is Bertha Pappenheim. Has anyone ever heard of her? No, no one's heard of her. Okay. You may have heard of this name, though. Have you heard of Anna O? Anna O was the famous, one of the case studies that Josef Breuer studies in his work, Studies on Hysteria. And he was a colleague of Sigmund Freud. And Bertha Pappenheim, who later it becomes known that she was actually Anna O. So she suffered from very acute forms of hysteria. She, what they call hysteria in those days, which it sounds silly, but they did believe it had something to do with the woman's uterus, and it influenced her brain, and but that's seemingly what they believed. But there were things that Breuer and Freud developed that became basically the foundations of psychoanalysis. And Anna O was one of the important case studies. Really, her father passed away when she was quite young. She was a caretaker for her father, and she took his death very difficult. And it was very, very, she describes many of her reactions to his death. And it was a very difficult and situation. Now, why do I mention her in this context? Because Bertha Pappenheim was a religious Jew. She was a frum Jew. She grew up in Germany, and although she did struggle with this period of depression or what we'll call psychosis, she, Baruch Hashem, seemingly got out of it. She was able to handle it and deal with it. And her second period of her life, she was devoted to the issues that I was mentioning before. She saw the thousands of women that were, without education. She saw that there were these women who got involved in human trafficking, and she created orphanages and different organizations in Germany. She founded the Jewish Women's Association. She was very active, a proto-feminist. She was really working very hard to defend the women of her time. And in fact, she crosses paths with Sarah Schneer, and she was actually very close with the Beis Yaakov movement. We'll talk about that later on. And one of the things she does, and it was a really incredible thing, that she would go around, she had means, she was from a wealthy family, and that's how they could afford to pay for Josef Breuer's treatment, and they put her on this sanatorium where she would hang around and they would relax. And that's this picture she's photographed at one of her sanatoria retreats, where she's wearing sort of a riding outfit for horses. And so she seemed to have enough means to be able to travel. And she would go into these different areas in Egypt and in different areas in Europe, where she found out there were people trafficking slaves and prostitution. And she was this little 4'10" woman, and she would go into these places and shut them down. And she was a very, I would say, heroic figure. And she got involved in controversy. She was very vocal about the issues that were going on and the lack of, you know, Torah education for women. And she was, you know, she actually visited Galicia, and she saw the issues that were going on in there. And she was involved in sort of documentation and this battle against the prostitution and the human trafficking that was going on. Here is a photograph from 1904 of the first board of one of her organizations. And she is in the first row, second from the left. I think that is her in her older years. Okay. As I mentioned to you, this is the source about the prostitution. So Shaul Stampler writes this, that it was, you know, one of the less savory aspects of Eastern European Jewish life. And he writes here that these procurers would often pose as suitors looking for a wife were the key. They preyed on single women who wanted to fulfill traditional roles as wives and mothers. The true intent of the husband or groom was revealed after marriage or after the woman had gone off with a newly found friend who promised marriage. And so often it was not, you know, they weren't actively looking, and they were sort of swept up or kidnapped by these people. However, there was a desperation here for women to look for husbands. And they were really, you know, they were really afraid of being left alone, and they didn't have any financial ability to provide for themselves. And in many cases, they were offered these dowries, and they would say that you need to, you know, you need to agree fast to it. However, and as Stampler points out over here, prostitution was not simply a result of the disappearance of traditional values, right? It's not just people were not from anymore and they didn't really care. In certain key respects, the opposite was the case. Traditional values remained through traditional patterns of behavior had been abandoned. So in other words, the community sort of had its structure, but people were no longer, you know, buying into it. So you have these women who were not, you know, they didn't connect with their parents. They didn't feel they wanted to, you know, marry these men that were being, you know, sort of arranged for them. And they really had no way of making, you know, escaping from these situations. And they would try to run away, or, you know, once they had, you know, become part of this whole world, it was very difficult for them to return because there was such a stigma against it. So that is a very, you know, it's a painful thing to think about. It's not something that we yet generally, you know, imagine happened in the shtetl in the old days. But that seems to be what the newer research is showing. And, you know, it seems to be, you know, a very unfortunate and terrible thing that happened to many, many Jewish women. Okay. So not only do we have a lack of interest in this old style of living, but we also have, as we mentioned, a lack of Jewish education. So not only were girls and women, let's say, desperate for a way out of this culture, but they also were not even inspired in any way to maintain their connection to the community. So many women who, as I mentioned to you, would end up in these Catholic convents and were sent to public schools, did not even have the ability to read from a sitter. They didn't know how to read Hebrew. So they knew Yiddish, some of them. In those days, about 6 out of 10 males were literate, and women were much lower. So we're talking about a literacy percentage that was very low. And they were starting to become more, as I mentioned to you, assimilated. They were exposed to Catholicism. Some of them, you know, actually converted. There's a huge number of cases, and again, it made the press, of women who, when they were sent to these convents, they never came home, and they decided to live a Catholic life. And there was a huge crisis. And what Bertha Pappenheim and Sarah Schneer, we'll see later, what they were saying, and what Rabbi Landau said in 1903, although that conference failed, what we need to educate our Jewish girls and women. They don't have the basic understanding of what it means to live a Jewish life. They're not inspired. They don't know, you know, what the values are. They're not interested And it was really like we think of today, like we have so many children leaving the fold and it's a terrible thing. And I'm not trying to downplay it. But the situation in those times was a terrible, terrible time where women didn't find for these men. There were no from women in the younger generations. People were not interested. So that was the situation in Galicia and, as I mentioned, in Poland, based on these laws of, you know, as I mentioned, the compulsory education acts and different laws, which caused the, you know, possibly was one of the main factors in causing this ripple effect of many of the girls going to public school. However, there were all, in addition to this community, we know that there were other communities in Europe, and there are some early precedents that I'd like to share with you that, you know, for supporting and, yeah, exactly, yeah. The good old days were, there was positive things, and I don't want to, you know, I guess I should put maybe a disclaimer that this year is a little bit more of a downer, you could say, but we're setting the scene for what, how Sarah Schneer really incredibly saved the entire Jewish community. So don't worry, there is a happy side to the story. But yes, the good old days had its challenges. I mean, besides for this, we have abject poverty. We have, you know, a low literacy, level of literacy. We have, you know, World War I, we're going to, you know, totally displaced everyone. We know World War II was a huge, you know, destruction. But World War I, everyone was displaced. You know, people died. It was also a tremendously, tremendously damaging war and very difficult to maintain a traditional framework within a community that had very little means, very little education. And even for men, like Shaul Stamper points out, like there's this picture of all the men were old, educated, they went to yeshivas, and the girls, they didn't know anything. And it was really wasn't so black and white. Like the men also didn't really know that much. The literacy level was very low. And women actually had a very high degree of, you know, considering that time in society, a high level of education, but in the secular world, in the secular realm, they were not being educated to you know, in Torah. They were being educated in the public schools, in the Catholic schools. And that's sort of the issue that you could see why the traditional literature would sort of, you know, sort of step around these type of things. Like, you know, the story goes that Sarah Schneer was the seamstress and she started seeing the skirts going up. Like there's sort of that myth and that legend, but they don't say it right straight out what was going on. But literally all around for decades, not, you know, Sarah Schneer founds Beis Yaakov in 1917. So in the 19th century, mid-19th century, for decades, we're talking about 50, 60, 70 years of this issue without any resolution, with women leaving the fold, getting involved in terrible things, and some of them converting, and you know, nothing was done about it. So although it does paint a negative picture, there was a lot that they were dealing with at the time. Like, and anyone, you know, I don't mean to downplay any one particular issue, but that was one issue among many of the challenging issues of those times. And, you know, in addition to the Haskalah, in addition to the Enlightenment, in addition to abject poverty and the upheaval during World War I. And so, okay, so the next thing I wanted to just talk about is, yes, there were no, you know, formal opportunities for women to study Torah. However, there were other communities that did already have precedent for women studying Torah, and we'll talk a little bit about the informal opportunities as well for women studying Torah. So, again, just giving background on the whole story of Sarah Schneer, it's important to know sort of, you know, some of the precursors. So we have Rabbi Sham Shonfal Hirsch, who is a personal favorite of mine. So he was born in 1808 in Hamburg, Germany. And all the way back in 1836, when he was around, I'm terrible at math, but I guess he was around, 28. And he writes a huge work that he entitles Chorev, Moriah, and he goes to a publisher in Germany, And the publisher says, non-Jewish publisher says, this is too big. Why don't you write an introduction, see if people are interested, and then you could sort of, you know, sell your bigger work. So he listens and he writes the 19 letters. And that's how we have the 19 letters. The 19 letters really was written as a marketing ploy for his major work, Chorev. Why do I mention this? Because in addition to it just being interesting, in the title page of the work, Chorev, Rabbi Hirsch writes a very interesting line, and I don't really know how to pronounce German, but I'll do my best. So here is so you have this work, which is for Ubi Yisrul, I'm not sure what that is, but that's Yisrul. And here you have the J is pronounced like Y in German, for Yisrul, Bedente, or Gedente, Jungling, and Junge Freund, probably saying it terribly, but here Freund is women, and Junglin is young men. So you have this dedication here to young thinking Jewish men and Jewish women. And that was very ahead of the times. This is already back in 1836. And Rav Hirsch, he found a school in 1853 called the Real Shul in Frankfurt. So not only does he have this vision of his work, Chorev, which was a very sophisticated Jewish work of Jewish thought, you know, addressing men and women, and he implements this vision into actuality. And he builds a shul in Frankfurt, Germany. And it's called the Real Shul. The Real Shul really had about four different schools all within one institution. He had an elementary school, which was both for women and for girls and boys. He had a high school for boys and a high school for girls. And he also had a school for the Ausstudenten, for the Eastern European Jews who didn't really fit into the other schools within his structure. So all the way in 1853, Rav Hirsch founds a school, gives a formal traditional education for opportunities for women, for girls really, and from the elementary school to the high school. And that was, to my knowledge, in modern times, the first place you have an institutionalized traditional framework for women learning and Torah study for women. So that's in 1853. And Rav Hirsch writes in Chorev this line, and it does seem somewhat dated, but it is, you know, it's on the map. Jewish women's and Torah study is on the map. He writes the following: no less should Israel's daughters learn the contents of the written law and the duties which they have to perform in their lifetime as daughter and young women, or maybe it says daughters, as mother and as housewife. I think he's referring to them as, you know, nouns. So yes, he does sort of give them their traditional roles, but he's saying that there's no reason that we should not be teaching our daughters Torah. So it's on the map. Formalizing education for women is on the map in the Jewish community in 1853. Now, as we mentioned, Galicia and Poland and Hungary were way behind. They were dealing with a very different community, much more traditional, and there wasn't as much of an upheaval from the Haskalah. In Frankfurt, Rav Hirsch was dealing with a very different community, fighting different battles, and it's hard to judge. But I would just like to note this is an early precedent for the study of women learning Torah, and it's going to be very important for the future of the Beis Yaakov movement, because we will see that Sarah Schneer is heavily influenced by Rav Chaim Shmuel Hirsch and his Torah thought, and his students and his students' students. Another source I would like to share with you is a source, Or Yisrael. This is source number 4, and Rav Yisrael Salanter. This is written by Rav Yisrael Salanter as a letter in Vilna. So Vilna again is in Lithuania. So we're not in Germany anymore, and the scholars date this letter to around the year 1843, 1845. So it's early. And Rav Yisrael writes, put, you know, again, as I mentioned in the Musar series, I think I made reference to this, but he's an early source for the encouragement of women studying Torah, although he does only really encourage Musar, that was really his agenda. So it's not clear to me if this means that he would encourage them to learn other things as well, but here we have Rav Yisrael Salanter in 1845 or 1843 writing a letter encouraging women to study Torah. He writes that Nashim Peturos Mitama Torah, women are exempt from studying Torah. Not to say they can't, but he's saying that they are exempt. However, Lo Kain Limud Alazeh, he's talking about Musar, this study, they are not exempt from. It's a Chiyuv Mukaf. It is an all-encompassing obligation. L'chol nefashos achas lo nedar. Every single person is obligated. Not one should be exempt. And this is, again, a very early source. As opposed to Rav Hirsch, Rav Yisrael Salanter does not ever implement it in a formalized, structured way. But, again, important to note that you see there was already sort of this awareness, this recognition that we need to inspire the 50% of our community, the female Jewish girls and Jewish women. Something also to note, which I'm not going to go so much into because I don't have that much more on it than a few things. But in the school of Chabad Lubavitch, they also were earlier in the encouraging of women, Torah study for women. The Riyat of Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe. He really, not in the context of really Torah study for women and educational formalization of opportunities in schools, it's not really what his focus was. The question became, do women constitute, you know, are they just the wife of this family or this husband or the daughter of so-and-so, but they are not their own chassidos, you would say, or perhaps they are their own individual chassidos of the community, of the Rebbe, of whoever it was. And the Riatz, and then much more later, the most recent Lubavitcher Rebbe, emphasized to his community that every single woman is her own chassid of the Rebbe. In other words, they're not just sort of like this wife of, or daughter of, or, you know, sister of so-and-so. They had their own standing in the community, and that was encouraged in their communities. Other opportunities for Jewish women and Jewish girls moving back to away from Germany, because as I mentioned, it was a very different community, and we will talk about its influence on Sar Schneer. It's very, very important. And in general, the whole Agudas Yisrael movement, which we also will talk about, was very much influenced by the involvement of German Jews and their connection and their partnership with the Ger Rebbe and the Hasidish community. But if we move back to Eastern Europe, Lithuania and in Russia and in Poland, there were other opportunities, less traditional and less formalized, but other opportunities nonetheless for women to study Torah. So we mentioned many women were studying in public schools, right? That was, we have this notion like, you know, all the people came to America, there was mass immigration, and they, chassideste. Okay, well, it's very similar to the nickname they gave Sar Schneer. They called her chassidka. They called her
chassideste.
Chassideste. So you know more Yiddish than me, probably. Chassideste, yes. Yeah, so they called her little Miss Chassid, or chassideste. So we'll talk about that also, that Sar Schneer sort of was this very pious and almost, you know, people would make fun of it. But yes, it seems like we have some educated listeners here. So thank you very much for that. What was I saying? Oh, so if we go back to Eastern Europe and Russia and Poland, there were other opportunities for women to learn Torah. And we mentioned that many women were in, oh, I was saying about in America. People have this notion that they talk about, you know, the Treif of Medina, and people went to America and it was terrible, and they all sent their kids to public school and they went off to Dera. Oh, while there is truth to that, the reality is that for generations, perhaps the people were going to public school beforehand. This was already something that was plaguing the community in the mid 19th century. So the notion that, you know, America, you know, brought everyone off the derech, yes, it was a challenge because there was a new culture, and yes, it was a challenge because everyone wanted to be America and they were embarrassed of being religious and from, but there were already public schools in Hungary, in Poland, in Russia, that people were going, especially women, in mass. So that's a reality that is just, I think, sort of, you know, I guess, busting that myth that public school is the reason why everyone went off to there in America. So we see that they had opportunities to learn outside of the Jewish framework. But there were also other things that were going on, although not as formalized. So there was something called, it sounds a little strange to even say, but there were chadarim for women. There were chadarim, even as early as the 16th and 17th centuries, that were these little Talmud Torahs, smaller schools with one teacher, not much, in the ways of extracurriculars and, in student governments or anything like that. But they had these little, these little chadarim, and women they often had for girls, just teaching them Torah, Talmud Torahs, and different things along those lines. Now, as I mentioned to you, the cheder model was very, very decrepit. There was not much funding for it. There was, the teachers were not of the highest caliber, and there was a much need of reform. And there was a movement in Russia that came along and said, we're going to fix the cheder system, and we're going to create something called the cheder mitukan. The cheder mitukan, or the cheder mesukan, was, and they actually used that terminology, even though they were early Chovei Tzion followers, but they still had not, moved to the modern Hebrew, and they used, Ashkenazi's pronunciation. So they formed this new cheder, and they would, if you want to translate it as progressive or improved, but they said, we were going to make a new cheder. And many of these chadarim were open to women, to girls, as well as boys. Either they were co-ed, that was the real cheder mitukan, or they were just separate, but they had opportunities for girls to learn, and they had a whole program for girls. But they were influenced by the Haskalah and by the Chovei Tzion, and they incorporated ideas like Jewish nationalism. Now, the Tsar, because we're talking about 18th century and 19th century Russia, the Tsar was not a fan of the cheder mitukan. He was very upset about this. And the more conservative elements within the community were also not happy about this. We don't want our children learning about Jewish nationalism. We don't want them learning about different secular ideas. So there was a, as I mentioned to you, they were using Ashkenaz's pronunciation. So what the critics were saying about these chadarim is they're calling it a cheder mesukan. It's really a cheder mesukan with a samach and not a saf. It's a dangerous cheder. We can't send our kids to that cheder. And they were, they spoke negatively against these chadar. Now, to give you an idea of how many chadarim I'm talking about, by 1903, there were close to 1,000 cheder mitukans throughout Russia. And many of them, not all of them, but many of them had programs for girls. So we're talking about a massive movement. And again, people think that Sarah Schneer came on the scene and she saw a problem that no one saw, didn't realize, didn't know what to do. It's not the case. There were other alternatives. Maybe they were less traditional, but there were other alternatives that were already happening for years without any, formalized structure that was approved by the traditional institutions. However, they were going on at the time, and it was in mass. Other schools, after World War I, as I mentioned, this huge upheaval of World War I, now we're in what's called interwar Poland, because all the different boundaries and borders became, jumbled up and everything. There were other schools that sprung up. The Tarbut schools, which I think is translated as culture schools, there were, the Zionist schools, the Tarbut, and the Tarbut had co-education. So we had women opportunities to learn within a more secular but Jewish environment. The Bundist and the Polei Tzion organizations had the different schools. They had the Tzisha schools, and they had the different, thousands of students as well. And both of these schools were coeducational. So we had women learning in those schools. Now, it's debatable how anti-religious Tarbut was, and And what they were saying, you know, definitely the Zisha schools were definitely anti-religious. But at the end of the day, they were educational models for women. There was a very famous school, the Yehudia school in Warsaw. That was a very wealthy and upper class school. There was a school, and this was, I would say, a forerunner, perhaps, one could argue, for the Beis Yaakov movement. There was a school system that already started schools in Telz and in Kovna and in Kelm called the Chavatzela schools, or Chavatzela. And these schools were, as I mentioned to you before, were founded by a few German Yekesha rabbi doctors. And we'll talk a little bit more about them coming up. We have Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Karlbach. And he, along with some of his other colleagues, go and, you know, offer what they have already been doing in Germany and Frankfurt for already 40 years. They start, you know, influencing the structural, institutional structures in Eastern Europe. And this is the beginning of the offering German solutions, we'll call them Jewish German solutions, to Eastern European Jewish communities. And this is really what much of what happens in the Aguda, what happens in Beis Yaakov, is that there's a sort of a partnership between what was happening already in German Frankfurt and German communities for the Jewish women learning and for the institutional structural political movements. So in 1921, there was a gymnasium founded, this Chavatzelitz girls school in Telz. And there was a direct involvement with Rav Yosef Leib Bloch, the Rosh Hashiva of Telz, and they started this school. To show you how important that school was, later when Beis Yaakov had a convention, it was held at the Chavatzelitz school, if I'm not mistaken, in Warsaw, if I'm not mistaken. But it was held, this convention, it was a different institution. Chavatzelitz was a different institution, but it was a very, there was a very important influence and perhaps even a forerunner for Beis Yaakov. There were also different schools called the Yavne schools, which were in Telz and in Panovich, again, a little bit more traditional. But none of these schools, although they, you know, there was, as I mentioned, there, you know, hundreds of students, thousands of schools eventually, they were not institutionalized, and they certainly were not in the general traditional framework of Jewish study. Chavatzelitz is probably, in Yavne, were probably exceptions, but they were not, you know, they were nowhere near the success that we will see that Beis Yaakov had at, you know, sort of this mass institutional structure that was seamless, you know, it appears seamless, but I'm sure there were, you know, it took a lot of effort, but they were very much connected, and all the schools had this very similar culture. And we'll talk a lot more about how Sarashnir was so able to be so successful when so many institutions were failing, and so many progressive and anti-religious schools, public schools, Catholic schools, were competing for the Jewish girls. How was Sarashnir so successful? So that's really, I'll leave you with that question, and we'll really answer that question mostly next time. But here you see, just to guess, to cap the entire discussion and to give a sort of a summary of what was going on at the time. So as we mentioned, assimilation, unfortunate prostitution. We have not as many opportunities for women's learning, although there were these other schools that were starting to, you know, to be formed. And there was a lack of cohesive rabbinic infrastructure that they didn't come to any solution. Someone raised this issue and others said, we're not going to teach the girls Torah, no way. And really nothing was done about it. We had, you know, vocal critics, and I would say, you know, who did some heroic things like Bertha Pappenheim. But again, she doesn't start a school. She was involved, as we'll see, and she was very close with the Beis Yaakov movement and she supported it, but she doesn't herself found this school. And for many years, since the Compulsory Education Act in 1869, I would say for about 50, 60 years, the community is sort of, you know, reeling and not sure how, what are we going to do? How can we, what, how are we going to basically marry off our children? How are we going to keep our daughters connected? And we had, you know, these different stories and you know, individuals, but it was a general trend of people and daughters not feeling connected to their parents, not being feeling connected to their religion, and not having many traditional opportunities to study Torah. So I will leave you with that sort of gloom picture. Although, don't forget, we had, you know, thank God our hero Sarah Schneer comes into, you know, onto the scene, and we'll pick up with her and her story and how she was inspired and the controversy and the pushback and her story, God willing, next time. Thank you everyone for coming. We will see you next week. Next week, we'll do it. I think it's going to be on Thursday, because there is a women's base medrash program on March 1st, I believe, which is the next Tuesday night. So I didn't want to conflict with that event. So we're going to be getting together on Zoom at 8:30 on March 4th. Is it a Thursday? No.
March 4th is Shabbos.
Sorry. So March 3rd, I guess. March 3rd, Thursday night, God willing.
Sounds good. Thanks for whetting our appetite.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Everyone have a great night.
Bye.